You're listening to Sipping on Some Crime podcast, hosted by Aaron. This podcast covers sensitive and triggering subjects, explicit language, and mature content which may not be suitable for children. As always, all parties are innocent until proven guilty.
Today, we'll be covering the unsolved murder of Madame Shirley Fenn.
It was 1975, and it appears someone found it amusing to ask the mum of three to dress up for her own death.
She came here to the Royal Perth Golf Club dressed in a full-length ball gown worth thousands of dollars. The Kwinana Freeway, just metres away. A Vice Squad detective would later say it's a known meeting spot for police and their informants.
The 33-year-old was shot four times at close range with a sawn-off rifle.
This case takes place in South Perth, Western Australia. It's one of Australia's biggest unsolved cases and has garnered lots of national media attention throughout the years. There's so much corruption with police and politicians that go into this case, which is why 46 years later, this case is still on the minds of many Australians. Shirley June Sherwing was born November 2nd, 1941 in Fremantle, Western Australia. She was the eldest of four siblings. Her father was a bomber pilot and was gone a lot of the time in her youth, so she was brought up by her mother during her early years. After the war, her family decided to move to Mount Pleasant, a riverside suburb where they lived comfortably. Shirley was a teenager before she had three younger siblings into her life. Many articles and documentaries mention that Shirley started having family troubles around the age of 13. There's not a lot of details I can find on what those troubles may have been. Maybe being the only child so long and three siblings coming into the picture suddenly, along with a move, and her father now being more present due to his retirement from service, this possibly could have caused some friction. Even with the family troubles, Shirley was a really good student and a generally well-behaved child. But by age 14, she was caught being sexually active with a man in his 20s. When this was discovered, she was brought in front of the magistrate, and her punishment was to be committed for 8 months to a notoriously cruel Catholic Church welfare home. This welfare home had all the girls sentenced to spending their days doing laundry. The thought was that these girls would do loads and loads of laundry for hotels and other businesses, and through washing all these dirty linens and clothes, it would somehow cleanse their souls of the sins they had committed. It is said that Shirley was molested at this home, and it made her very resentful. Being sent to this Catholic laundry and being taken advantage of is what would change the course of young Shirley's life forever. After 8 months in the Catholic laundries, Shirley would return to school and quit. She found work at a dress shop where she would meet her husband-to-be, Des Fenn. Des was a 22-year-old Air Force mechanic at the time, and Shirley was looking for some sort of stability and to feel loved. She thought that she had found that in Des. Shirley and Des married in Perth and then moved to Melbourne. Des continued in the Air Force and Shirley picked up a job as a sales assistant at a store called Buckley & Nunn, a department-style store. Shirley and Des would go on to have children pretty quickly in their marriage. Her sons Steve and Shane were born both in 1959 and 1960. Des would be transferred back to Perth in 1961, and that is when they would have their daughter, Bridget. When Shirley was just 21, Des, now 28, suffered a serious injury that left him with a mental instability and anger issues. People say Des already wasn't very easy to deal with and had a quick temper, so this definitely put a strain on their marriage. Des was now no longer able to support the family. Shirley knew she had to be the breadwinner. She had to find a way to keep this family afloat. In 1960, Perth saw a huge mining boom, which brought in laborers from all over, which guaranteed lots and lots of clientele for sex workers. And that industry just took off. There were brothels and massage parlors popping up on every corner. It was becoming a big problem for the city. However, for Shirley, she saw an opportunity to support her three children. She couldn't take any more of Dez's abuse, as it got worse through their marriage after his injury. So she split from him and decided to take care of their children on her own. There was a witchcraft coven which held activities in Kings Park that Shirley joined to make money. This group allowed her to advance her career in body painting and an escort business. Shirley had her own body painting and escort service after a few years in the business, but it would be raided by the police and shut down. Shirley was charged with keeping premise of the purpose of prostitution. Of course, in this community, after she was charged, her and her family were now ostracized because of the career path that she had chose, and her children were actually forced to leave the Catholic primary school that they were attending. Although it was illegal, the massage parlor, prostitution, body painting, and escort businesses began to grow bigger and out of control. Perth knew that they had to do something to control it, so they created the containment. This containment effort was upheld by the West Australian Police. The number of brothels were set up under a symbolic protection of Australian vice overlord Abe Saffron. Abe Saffron was a hotel owner, nightclub owner, property developer, but he was also a major figure in organized crime in Australia. They believe that Saffron was involved in a wide range of criminal activities, including stolen goods, illegal grant gambling, prostitution, drug dealing, bribery, extortion, federal tax evasion, illegal alcohol sales, and the list continues. I can't quite get the correlation of where the containment effort with the West Australian Police and Abe Saffron came together. Maybe someone out there listening knows and can help us out. But it seems like they used him to help set up the properties and rein in all the girls and the owners of these brothels because he knew the system so well. Basically, this points to the very shadiness of the containment effort by the West Australian Police to begin with. Chief Bernard Johnson of the Vice Squad was the one who was assigned to be in charge of the containment effort. Johnson decided which girls were going to work, where they were going to work, and when they were going to work. He was also the one who decided where the brothels would be located and who would run them. After Shirley's brothel was raided by Vice Squad Bernard Johnson, he came to her and offered her to be part of the containment program. He explained that she would be given protection and allowed to run her brothel and her girls, but it was going to cost her. Johnson told Shirley she would have to pay a protection fee. This fee would allow her to become one of the only three brothel madams in all of Perth at the time. Shirley agreed. Shirley opened her new brothel on 316 William Street in Perth under the containment in 1969. For Shirley to keep this brothel and be part of the containment, she had to come up with her pay packet every week, no excuses. It's believed, due to statements from other brothel owners, that they priced it out based on the amount per girl that was working. It was widely known that Johnson would meet Shirley every week in a quiet spot and collect her weekly packet. For the most part, it seems that those closest to Shirley was aware of how she made her money. Her friend Helen tells the reporter about the moment she realized the kind of business her friend Shirley was in.
When I learned what Shirley was doing for a living, I was shocked. And I said, Shirley, I don't understand how you could be working in this illegal business without coming to the attention of the police. And she said, the police know about it. I pay to stay in this business and I pay good money to them. I said, but Shirley, what sort of an impact will this have on your children? And she said, funny you should say that. She said, I have this reoccurring dream where I'm lying in the gutter and my three children are looking down on me. I said, it could become a reality, Shirley.
Shirley had always had the belief that ownership of something gave you legitimacy. It gave you a standing in the community. It gave you money to give your family a better life. So when Shirley purchased her home in a gorgeous, well-to-do neighborhood, she wasn't going to give up that home easily. It was her way of legitimizing all the hard work. Everything that she had gone through was wrapped up in the ownership of that home. To her, that home represented everything she had done for herself and her children. She was able to create her own social standing with that home, which she felt nobody could take away as long as she owned it. For a few years in the brothel business, Shirley dated a man named George. He was a motorcycle racer, and she actually sponsored him for a few years. But things didn't work out, but they did stay friends. Shortly after breaking up with George, Shirley would meet a woman named Rose, and they would begin a relationship, and Rose would move in to Shirley's beautiful home. Rose Black and Shirley would be in a relationship for over 2 years, which made them a domestic couple, which comes up later and is an important part of the investigation later on. However, while Shirley and Rose are in this relationship, it is said that Shirley is also having an affair with Ray O'Connor. Ray O'Connor was the Western Australia Police Minister in 1975. Lee Beswick was a driver for Shirley before eventually becoming a sex worker for her. Lee knew everyone that Shirley interacted with and what her schedule was like. She was with Shirley for a few years. Lee states that she actually drove Shirley and Ray quite a few times up to Kings Park, where she stated they'd have a little wine and hang out. Shirley was making quite a bit of money, and she was paying out quite a bit to keep herself in business. Unfortunately, while she was making lots of money, she ended up owing a huge amount of money in taxes that was over $100,000. And in 1975, that's a lot. Even though she was making good money, having to make these payments and then pay the fee that was due up front for all the taxes was going to put her one asset, the one thing she cared about most, the possession Shirley felt gave her family a sense of security, in jeopardy. Her beautiful home was at risk, and she was not willing to let that happen. So when Shirley got in trouble with the taxes, she decided to go to Ray. Lee remembers that conversation vividly as she drove Ray and Shirley up to Kings Park, like many times before. Lee heard their conversation about the taxes due and Shirley's concerns and remembers Ray telling Shirley that if you go down for this, I go down for this. Shirley had a tax hearing coming soon, just days away, and she had to show up with the money, and she wasn't willing to lose everything she had just built. Just days before Shirley's tax hearing, Shirley met with her friend Dawn Mack. Dawn Mack was in a relationship with a woman named Jacqueline. Jacqueline remembers that day and the conversation that Shirley and Dawn had. Jacqueline says Shirley came in and told Dawn, "Donnie, I am gone this time. I am gone." She went on to tell Donnie that she had told Owen that she was going to meet with the tax department on Tuesday, and if she didn't get help, she was going to name names. Dawn asked her what Owen had to say about that. Shirley said that Owen had told her to shut her mouth, watch what she said, or bang. The Owen Shirley is referring to was Owen Litch, the assistant commissioner for the West Australian Police at the time. And just a side note, I apologize if I'm getting any of these last names wrong. I'm trying to pronounce them the best that I understand, so my apologies if I'm butchering them. Owen goes on to tell Shirley that he's going to introduce her to an important person. Owen gave Shirley instructions to dress really, really nice. He specifically said not to dress trashy. He said to make sure she dresses to impress. He explained to Shirley that she will meet with this bloke and he will help her. A few days after that meeting, it would be Sunday, June 22nd, 1975. Shirley and Rose had a barbecue dinner with the kids around 6:30 that evening. Shirley's daughter Bridget remembers around 8 o'clock that night that her mother suggests that they have an early night and sent the kids up to their room. Around 9:40 p.m. that night, Shirley's neighbor's daughter was reversing out of her driveway and she recalls seeing Shirley getting into a car wearing a glamorous sparkling dress. Now, this is where we're not 100% clear on exactly how everything happened, but we know that Shirley drove down to the Royal Perth Golf Club. This club was very close to her home. We know this was her last location since this is where her car would be found. At the Royal Perth Golf Course is where investigators believe she met with her killer and was killed around midnight. The details are so hazy because of the lack of investigation done and the lack of a proper investigation being taken place, period. With Shirley's case, there are not many details on the case until the following morning. The news of a murder at Royal Perth Golf Club is highly publicized early that morning. The scene was off a major throwaway, so police activity on the scene drew public and press attention very quickly. Around 9:30 a.m., June 23rd, reporter Terry Willisey arrives to the scene to see a white Dodge sedan parked, both car doors open, with press and police officers milling around the car freely. Other reporters and photographers are walking around the scene, taking pictures, and talking with investigators. Terry decides to begin walking the scene. As Terry is walking around the car, he peers into the driver's door and sees a deceased woman dressed in a glittering gown in the front seat. He said the image still sticks in his mind today. Terry notes that at the time, he didn't think about the fact that there were reporters and police just milling around the scene, and that it was so open. But looking back later, when he stopped to think about it, he thought it was very odd that reporters were allowed to just walk around the scene like that. He found it strange how investigators were just allowing the scene to be so open with no worries about contamination. Bridget, Shirley's daughter, recalls waking up that next morning to get ready for school. She remembers how rainy it was that day, quite a downpour, and everything was just soaking wet. She went off to school like she normally did, and she was sitting in her first period social studies class when around 9:30 in the morning, the headmistress came in and asked for her. Bridget and the headmistress walked out into the hall together. Once they were in the hall together, the headmistress wrapped her arms around her and said to Bridget, "I don't know how you'll get through this." She explained to her that her mother had been found dead that morning. The police were not shy about being public with this murder at all, which is evident in how quickly they talked with press the following morning. It is said that this was done intentionally to send a clear message. Shirley's case was completely mishandled from the beginning. Not only did they have the press and other officers trampling around the grounds of the scene, many photographers peering into the cars and taking pictures, but they took zero effort to protect the scene. Something else that shocked reporters and future investigators would be that after the removal of Shirley's body from the driver's seat of her car, a detective would lay a white sheet over the seat, then get in the seat and drive Shirley's car away from the scene. There is actual footage of this happening. You can find it on my source links, which I'll include on the website. Another thing that stands out is that nobody looked in the trunk of the car on the scene or after the scene. Why wouldn't you open the trunk of a vehicle and see if there's anything else in there that could help you identify the killer? Why wouldn't you search and catalog the findings in this trunk? Wouldn't you want to make sure there's not possibly another body? There are a million reasons to look in this trunk, but the detectives on scene didn't feel like it was important. Makes you wonder how much they already knew. Shirley's friend Jacqueline heard about Shirley's death quickly, like the rest of the community. She recalled their conversation just a few days prior and wondered if she should go to the police. Upon thinking about it more and more, she wasn't sure if it was safe to go to the police. And if it was safe to go to the police, which ones were the right ones to go to? Having two young children of her own and not knowing which officers to trust, Jacqueline decides to stay quiet because she's too terrified to put her family at risk with the information she knew. As the investigation goes on in the months that followed, there are hundreds of leads. They are never followed up on. Less than a year into the investigation, the police hand over Shirley's file to the coroner, saying there's no prospect of ever finding a killer. They then close her case file. And that's that with Shirley's case until the early 2000s. In the early 2000s, a journalist named Juliet Wills is reading about the case and becomes very intrigued. She decides to do some digging on her own. By 2005, she had gathered extensive interviews and so much additional material on the case, including finding people that had other allegations about what happened that night. She even found new people willing to come forward and talk about the case. Juliet actually found a witness that had driven past the golf course and had seen Shirley's car around 6:30 that morning on the 23rd. His name was John Mearns. John states that as he was driving that morning, he noticed two cars parked just off the outside of the golf course. A few hundred more feet up as he was driving, that's when he saw a white Dodge sedan with both of its car doors open, and parked right alongside it was a green car. John decided to call the police department to relay this information. He was patched over to a sergeant who said, "Thank you very much for calling in, but we do have enough information on that already." John found that it was very strange. He didn't really know what to do with that response. He thought at the very least they would take his statement, but they just thanked him and hung up the phone. Juliet also interviewed Ray O'Connor. Remember, Ray O'Connor was the minister of police at the time of Shirley's death. He was also rumored to be having an affair with her at the time she was killed. After Shirley's murder, Ray would go on to become the state premier on the retirement of Sir Charles Court in 1983. It seems, though, during 1981 and 1982, he was investigated for fraud by the Western Australia Royal Commission, and he was tried in 1995 on charges of stealing $25,000 checks from Bond Corporation and was sentenced 6 months to jail. Juliet goes on to ask Ray if he knew who Bernie Johnson was. Bernie Johnson was allegedly the vice squad detective that Shirley would meet and pay for her protection to stay in the containment. More importantly, Bernie Johnson was also the first detective on the scene of Shirley Fenn's murder. Juliet asks Ray about his relationship with Shirley Fenn. Here's a clip of that interview.
How do you feel about the ongoing rumor that you were involved with Shirley Fenn?
Exactly. See, I never even met Shirley Fenn.
You never ever met her?
No.
There's been some people that have said you had quite a close relationship with her.
Never met her.
Did you know Bernie Johnson?
Yes.
She was also able to interview Bernie Johnson, and here's a small clip of that interview, which I wanted to share because I feel like this clip says so much about Bernie and his involvement.
We went down there. I knew it was Shirley Fenn's car, and I knew it was Shirley Fenn.
What went through your head?
Not the same as went through hers.
Before early 2005, Juliet had gathered so many interviews and so much new evidence proving that this case had a shot to be solved, had it actually been properly investigated at the time. Juliet had gone to Bridget, Shirley's daughter, to talk to her about all the findings, and together they formally applied for an inquest into the murder investigation of Shirley Fenn. For my listeners who are not from Australia like me and not familiar with their court system, an inquest is less formal than most court hearings. It's so that the coroner can inform themselves and gather information. The coroner hears the evidence on oath from people who have information about the death, including police officers, family members, and doctors, as well as other experts and eyewitnesses. An inquest is usually held in the magistrate's court closest to where the death had occurred. An inquest allows the coroner to make recommendations about matters connected with the death, such as public health and safety matters of the administration of justice to prevent similar deaths in the future. The coroner may also hold an inquest if there is such a high public interest to do so. They have the right to decide there is a significant amount of doubt in the cause of the circumstance of death. They use this system to uncover systematic issues that affect public health and safety. There's so much great information about an inquest, as who attends, what's presented, who's eligible to be a witness, and so much more. There is a lot of great information online that you can research about it if you have more questions. I could almost do a whole mini podcast on their process. It's very interesting. So Juliet and Bridget request an inquest and hand over all the evidence that they have acquired for it to be heard by the coroner. At first, their inquest is completely denied due to insufficient evidence. When they got that denial, Bridget felt completely gutted. Juliet took all the tapes of the recordings of all these interviews and all the evidence she had spent years collecting and boxed it up and put it in her garage because she just felt that after all that work and being denied, she couldn't get pulled back into it. Juliet had put so much time into this case. She wanted to make it right for Shirley, and for them to get the denial like that just really hurt. Juliet felt like this is such a dark story and it consumes so much of her that she needed a break from the darkness. It would be years before Bridget and Juliet would come back together to apply for another inquest. Throughout those years, they kind of lost touch. Both of them just needed a break. Then in 2012, Juliet was working for Channel News 12. It had been years since she touched the Shirley Fenn story. Bridget had sat down and wrote this letter to Juliet, which she says was almost like a poem. Bridget wrote of the anguish and heartache of not knowing what happened to her mother that day and not having justice or any answers. And that just broke Juliet's heart. So Juliet called Bridget and said, okay, if we're going to do this, if we're going to jump back into this, if you want me on your side, I need you to come out to the public and start speaking up. Up until that point, Bridget had just let Juliet run everything and let her be the public spokesperson. Bridget had been quiet and kind of in the back because she just couldn't face the public side of it. So in September 2012, that's when Bridget decided that if her mother's case was ever going to get a chance, she would have to come out publicly. With Bridget coming out and speaking for the first time, that really threw this story back into the media and kept the spotlight on it.
The murder of Perth brothel Madam Shirley Fenn in the 1970s is one of our state's high-profile unsolved crimes. There are long-held allegations members of the WA police are responsible for her death. Now Shirley Fenn's daughter has spoken for the first time, desperate for police files on her mum's death to be handed over for independent investigation.
They say the wheels of justice turn slowly, but the wait can be agonising.
Consumes my life.
Bridget Fenn was just 13 when her mum was murdered.
We had a barbecue
I was sent to bed early. I got up the next morning and she wasn't home.
For Bridget Finn, years of guessing what happened to her mum has taken its toll. She wants answers.
I just want an inquiry or another state to take over the police files or for them to handle it over, not knowing there's no closure.
Because no one in Shirley's family had come forward until now to speak about this case, and the fact that her daughter had stepped up in front and saying she wanted the police files to be looked at, it brought not only a spotlight in Australia, but a spotlight in the whole world back onto Shirley Finn's case. Knowing that they needed to keep the media presence and pressure on the case, Juliet decided to write a book about the Finn murder and Shirley's life. With the release of that book, new evidence would soon come forward. For all of you that would like to know what it is, it's called Dirty Girl, the state-sanctioned murder of a brothel, Madam Shirley Finn. It goes into a lot more of Shirley's personal life, the way she was raised, and how she became one of the brothel madams. It definitely takes a deeper dive into Shirley's murder investigation and into Juliet's personal investigation into her death. Shortly after the release of the book, Juliet received a message from a retired police officer named Brian Eddy, who would have some information on the Shirley Finn case. It would be Brian Eddy's evidence that would change the course of this investigation. Brian would say that a night or two before Shirley's death, he had seen her at the police canteen in the company of two detectives on the force. However, within a few days of reporting this, he was driving down the road during his night shift on his motorcycle when he heard the roar of an engine car zoom up in front of him. They then knocked the right side of his motorcycle, sending him into the sand. Four guys got out of the car. One of them had a flashlight. One of them had a gun. The older of the four said to Brian, "If you want to see your kids again, shut your mouth. You didn't see anything." Brian was absolutely positive that there were detectives on the force, but because of his family, he kept his mouth shut for 40 years. After coming forward with this evidence, they were finally granted the inquest into Shirley Finn's murder in 2017. The news broke about the inquest being granted, and the story and the media coverage was huge again. Shirley Finn's case would be back in the spotlight, which would also put the West Australian police and their handling of this investigation also back in the spotlight. It's now 4 decades later, so a lot of these witnesses or potential suspects couldn't give evidence due to death, or like in the case of Bernie Johnson, he now had dementia, so it made it so it was impossible for him to even give evidence. The first few weeks of the inquest would be complete madness. So many witnesses saying different stories. One of these stories that came up was that Nettie Smith was actually sent to kill Shirley that night. Now, I know we haven't talked about Nettie yet, so let me give you a quick history lesson on who Nettie Smith is. Nettie Smith is still alive. He is in prison serving a life sentence since 1989. He was convicted on drug trafficking, rape, murder, theft, and armed robbery charges. In fact, he spent most of his life in prison before his life sentence. Nettie was known as a heroin dealer with a violent temper. He was an intimidating-looking man because of his weight and stature, standing at 6'6". He was known to be constantly involved in brawls at bars and in street fights. Nettie became even more wider known when he became the star witness and the whistleblower for the ICAC, otherwise known as the Independent Commission Against Corruption. Nettie testified against New South Wales police detective Roger Rogerson and other alleged corrupt officers in exchange for immunity for everything except the murder charges. A policeman would tell the court in the inquest that he had a tip that Nettie Smith, a known hitman, had killed Shirley. He said that Detective Hancock at the time told him to let that tip go. Hancock was the former head of the CIB, Criminal Investigation Branch, at the time of Shirley Finn's murder. I know there's a lot of players in this story, so stick with me. Hancock's full name is Donald Leslie Hancock, known as Dan Hancock. He was most well known for his involvement in the investigation of the Perth Mint Swindle, which is a popular name for the robbery of 49 gold bars stolen from the Perth Mint in Western Australia on June 22, 1982. According to the police at the time, it was three brothers, Ray, Peter, Brian, that orchestrated the robbery, and those three went to trial and were found guilty of the conspiracy and sentenced 26 and 12 years in jail. The case convictions were eventually overturned in 2004, and the case remains unsolved. Hancock is also most widely known for his death in a car bombing in 2001. This car bomb was said to be placed under his car by Gypsy Joker in revenge for the murder of Billy Garrison, allegedly caused by Hancock after Garrison had made an obscene comment in front of his daughter in 2003. Side note, as you can see, there is mass corruption within the police force in Western Australia. And this case is kind of a stain on the public's trust with that police force, which is why I believe it was hard to get this inquest. I believe they really didn't want this case to come back into the spotlight, because obviously when we start pulling this case back into the spotlight, we start to discover more blatant corruption. Now back to the inquest. The police officer has told the court that he reported this tip to Hancock that Nettie was involved in Shirley's death, but there's no proof and there was absolutely no follow-up into this tip. As the inquest went on, it became apparent that more and more questions came up during the inquest than answers. There was, however, a common evident thread of police corruption that went beyond their department into politics. There's also clear proof of evidence that there were madams paying protection money to the police. Another previous madam came forward and testified. Her name is Linda Watson. In 1979, 4 years after Shirley's death, Linda wanted to open a brothel. So she went to the police and asked them if she met the criteria to do such. Linda says the officers told her that she did meet the criteria, but that it was going to cost her $100 a week per girl. She said that was the moment she knew, yes, these cops were corrupt.
Two police officers were there, and I said, I want to open up a place. Do I meet the criteria? Oh, yes, you know, yes, we're happy for you to do that, but it's going to cost you $100 a week. And I went, $100 a week? Yeah, per girl. And I thought, shit, it's true. They're corrupt.
Shortly after this conversation, while setting up her brothel, Bernie Johnson drops by to visit Linda. Bernie asks her about a police officer, and he tells Linda he wants to take this copper down. He told Linda if she doesn't help take this officer down, she'll never work in this town again. Bernie then bends down so that his eyes are aligned with hers and says into her ear, and then you'll end up just like Shirley Fenn. As the inquest goes on, they request to hear from Rose Black. Now, Rose Black was in a relationship and living with Shirley at the time, and we call that a domestic partnership here. There, they call it a de facto relationship. Basically the same thing as a domestic partnership. We know that Rose had so much evidence, but what we didn't know is that she feared for her life since Shirley was murdered. Yet, as scared as Rose was, she does eventually come forward and start talking during the inquest. Rose tells the court that a few days before Shirley's murder, there was a meeting at the house. Bernie Johnson had come over. She couldn't see him, but she could hear his voice. Shirley and Bernie were counting money from garbage bags in the living room. After Bernie and Shirley finished counting, Bernie left. Shirley was left with the bags of money that they had just counted and was to take them to the meeting that Owen had set up for her. Rose said that Shirley was very scared about going to the meeting that Owen had set up for her. Rose, seeing that Shirley was visibly shaken about the idea of going to the meeting herself, told her that she would hide in the trunk of the car during the meeting if it would make her feel safer. But Shirley told her she couldn't hide there because that's where they'd be putting the bags of cash. The next day, on June 23rd, the morning that Shirley was discovered murdered at the golf course, a police officer went to Shirley's to talk to the family and get some information. That officer noticed on the coffee table that there were two photo albums. He picks them up and starts looking through them. And as he's looking through them, he notices there are pictures of Shirley in her backyard by the pool with no other than Ray O'Connor. The officer continues to flip through the photos and recognizes more senior officers and more politicians. He says he was genuinely shocked to see them there. Now, we know Ray O'Connor says he never knew her, but these photos were evidence, the evidence that they needed to prove that Ray knew Shirley. The officer took these photos into evidence, and these photo albums quickly vanished, never to be seen again. So many suspects, witnesses, and new information came forward during this inquest. But the name that stuck out the most was Bernie Johnson. However, before the end of the inquest, he died. The inquest was started at the end of August 2017. The public hearing was adjourned on December 2017 and then picked back up again July 23rd, 2018. It had been adjourned for 6 months to allow for new leads to be followed up and two scientific investigations to be completed. However, basically, the end of the inquest states that they are looking for people to come forward. The coroner agreed there was an inadequate investigation at the time of Shirley's murder, but basically, it sits as it is until someone comes forward with new information in the case. Until then, nothing will move forward. Shirley's daughter, Bridget, says that she can move on from this, She can leave it alone, but it won't leave her alone.
I can move on from this. I can leave it alone, but it won't leave me alone. I'll always have someone popping up with some, I heard this, she knows that.
However, Bridget got her inquest and gained so much more evidence and information from that. And in the end of that, it seems she got a sense of peace from that. You know I hate the word closure because you cannot close a chapter on the loss of someone you love to violence like that. For Bridget, it seems like she feels like she got some answers. But this case is still listed as unsolved. So with all the players and all the evidence, what do you think happened to Shirley that night? I think every victim's story is important to tell, and I hope that Bridget and her family do get the answers. I know that Bridget's life was very hard after her mother's death, as was her siblings. Before their mother's murder, they were in a nice school, a nice neighborhood. They had a nice life. And after her death, they not only lost their mother, but they lost everything. And their family continued to suffer more tragedy and loss going forward. For Bridget, getting the answer to her mother's final moments are what matter most to her. Keep sharing, retweeting, and retelling these victims' stories. Remember to keep sharing those faces because they get us closer to solving these cases. Until next time.